The next faculty member who met with me was Dr. Howard Hoxter. He began by commenting on his think tank topic, preoperative debulking with systemic therapy in patients being considered for a potentially curative resection of liver metastases.
If a patient has a clearly resectable liver lesion or two, I think you need to have a discussion with the patient and the surgeon, you know, whether it makes more sense to go for surgery first or give some induction chemotherapy and then go for surgery. I have never found it the case that we have harmed somebody by giving them chemotherapy first. In other words, they haven't developed a bowel obstruction or have not had such significant bleeding that they required emergent surgery. So it's an option to give chemotherapy first. We don't have data that that helps improve survival. Hopefully the EORTC study will show that eventually.
Can you talk about what that study's looking at?
That is for patients with resectable liver metastases. They're getting 3 months of FOLFOX before surgery and 3 months of FOLFOX after surgery or just surgery alone. So if that shows a survival benefit, then we would know we should treat people like that with chemotherapy first. But we also have to bear in mind that that is with FOLFOX alone, not with Avastin. And the Avastin must be stopped in time to not cause surgical problems, including potential for anastomosis breakdown. And I don't think that we actually have enough good data to know, you know, when to stop the Avastin beforehand. I mean, we've had a couple cases at 8 and 10 weeks after Avastin who've had wound and anastomosis breakdown, and it's been messy. So, you know, that will be another complicating factor if we use Avastin preoperatively.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach these patients in a non-protocol setting, and particularly the decision about whether or not to utilize systemic therapy before surgery on hepatic mets?
So now we're going to talk about the patient who either has too much liver disease to be resectable or maybe has, you know, one or two lung mets in addition. And the question would be, what would give you the greatest likelihood of reducing the bulk of tumor to the point of rendering the patient surgically curable? So, you know, I think that we need to use the treatments that give us the best responses. And personally, I prefer FOLFOX with Avastin as having the highest response rate. And I think the data, even in first line from the somewhat abbreviated SWOG study, shows that the addition of Erbitux first line does improve the response rate to chemotherapy. So we've got two antibodies, each of which does give you a higher response rate.
Can you talk a little bit more about that data set?
That was the CLGB study that was presented by Alan Vinook, and it was supposed to be a 2,200-patient study, but was stopped early at 280-some patients. But it was a 2x2 randomization of FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI plus or minus cetuximab. And when cetuximab was added, it showed about a 10 to 20% increase in the response rate for both arms. So that would suggest that in this study, you know, the addition of cetuximab to first-line chemotherapy will improve the response rate and hopefully will continue to make borderline resectable patient become resectable. If the other data that we should be seeing soon with respect to that would be from a large European trial called the CRYSTAL trial. That's FOLFIRI plus or minus cetuximab for first-line therapy. And according to the press release, that did achieve the primary objective of improved progression-free survival, but they didn't mention the response rates. But I assume that it will confirm that FOLFIRI plus cetuximab is a higher response rate.
Any way to estimate, you know, there's not really much data that you're talking about here, but how that would compare with using bevacizumab alone or using both antibodies?
Well, if you have, just as a benchmark, you know, in the pivotal trial from Hurwitz, 35% for IFL. So let's say in a phase 3 trial, you're going to have around 40% response rate for chemotherapy alone. You're probably likely to get 50% or 10% higher with the bevacizumab and hopefully another 10% higher with cetuximab, so maybe 60%. I mean, in phase 2 studies, people are already reporting 60-odd percent for some of these combinations of one antibody, but in the phase 3 trials, it's always lower.
So more specifically in terms of how you approach these patients, you first of all, you talk about, quote, being borderline resectable.
In the liver, it depends a little bit on what the surgeon's willing to do and how much liver the surgeon's willing to take out. But somebody who has extensive disease throughout both lobes of the liver is not going to be a good candidate for surgery initially, certainly.
Can you kind of remember any situations or CAT scans that you would call borderline and sort of why you or the surgeons felt like it was borderline?
Well, borderline, I think, would include the patients that, for the liver anatomy, either large tumors that abut blood vessels so that they really present a technical problem in terms of resection, or multiple tumors distributed pretty much throughout the liver. You know, if you got a few clustered, if you have two or three clustered in the right lobe and they can just do a, you know, one or two segment resection, that's one situation. But if it's really pretty small metastases, you have half a dozen all through the liver, it makes it really pretty difficult to resect.
What do we know about what's seen microscopically in lesions that by imaging have had a CR in the liver when you look at it histologically?
Well, we've had some cases where it's all dead cells. Sometimes you see a few cells that appear to be viable, but we don't have a good way to really know, other than kind of the microscopic guesstimate of the pathologist, if they're alive or dead. And then hopefully a rim of normal tissue so that all the margins are free.
Do we know, sort of, again, when you see a nodule that goes away with chemotherapy, how often, if you actually look in there, do you still see tumor?
I think that if you have a complete response and they go and resect that area, about 30-40% of the time you're going to find just like scar tissue there and no viable cells. And the rest of the time there's probably going to be something there. Now, whether that something is enough to cause a recurrence eventually or not, we don't know.
Can you review where we're at right now with double antibody therapy, what we know about it in terms of safety and efficacy?
Sure. For the combination of bevacizumab and cetuximab, we don't really have any data yet on the combination of bevacizumab with panitumumab. At least it's been released. But we know from the so-called BOND-2 study, which was an NCI phase 2 consortium trial that we participated in with Len Saltz and Memorial, that patients who had progressed on an irinotecan regimen but had not had Avastin previously, when they were treated with bevacizumab and cetuximab, they had like a 20% response rate as compared to 11% for cetuximab alone, and the toxicities were just as expected from either antibody. There was no unexpected or synergistic toxicities. You get the vascular stuff and the perforations from the bevacizumab, and you get the skin toxicity from the cetuximab.
What other studies are going on right now looking at that strategy?
Since we know it's safe, that's now kind of moved into a first-line question. And the two studies that are really looking at that today are the PACE study from Amgen. So that's already completed accrual. That's a first-line study of either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with bevacizumab in one arm versus bevacizumab and panitumumab in the second arm. And hopefully data on that will be coming out in the next year. And the other study is the CLGB intergroup study, which is a three-arm study that's powered for survival. So it's a much bigger study and does require everybody's participation and patient enrollment. So I'd like to encourage that. But in that study, the physician's choice of either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, and then a randomization to bevacizumab itself, cetuximab itself, or the combination of the two. So that will really be an excellent study if we can complete it, showing the relative merits of either using an anti-VEGF antibody, an anti-EGF antibody, or the combination of both. That should really give us some very clear data.
And I guess also there's been some discussion within the NSABP about what's the next adjuvant trial. They finished accruing to C08, FOLFOX plus or minus Bev, but they don't have an active study, and I know they're considering that as a possibility. Just make the leap, look at FOLFOX Bev plus or minus one of the two antibodies. What are your thoughts about that strategy in the adjuvant setting?
It seems like that should be the next step in adjuvant therapy also, but the kind of caveats on that are we don't know how well cetuximab is going to work in the adjuvant setting yet because we don't have the single agent activity from the North Central Group study. and we don't really have much safety data on the combination of the two antibodies. I mean, we do have a small trial, the Bond study, but that's 40 patients. I mean, it'll be more reassuring to go into a large adjuvant study based on the data from the PACE study, where we really have, you know, hundreds of patients who got both antibodies.
Do we have any data from that study in terms of safety?
Nothing's been presented yet. This is obviously an area that we can focus on that may have the biggest impact on a proportion of patients with colorectal cancer. I mean, historically, we've made a lot of progress in treating people with metastatic disease by moving out the median survival, but we still aren't talking about a lot of cures. The group that has resectable liver metastases seems to have approximately a 30% cure rate. And based on retrospective data, if you convert people to resectable from what the surgeons considered initially unresectable, they land up having the same 30% cure rate or five-year survival. So if we can bring 10-20% of patients into that group, in other words, converting them from the kind of borderline resectable to the resectable, and we can achieve those kind of cure rates, that will be, I think, an important step forward, and hopefully this would be the particular patient population that would seem most reasonable to focus a lot of drugs on to really make that happen.
What fraction of metastatic disease falls into that category?
I don't think that's very well characterized, but I'm going to guess it's maybe 10-20%.
How do these phase 3 trials like PACE and the intergroup study take into account the patient who's being considered for curative surgery? Are they allowed in the study, and then how do they evaluate it?
Yeah, they're allowed in the study because you just have to have metastatic disease, and I think the patient just goes to surgery and then they're censored at the time. But, you know, it's presumably would be equal in both arms or close to equal, and it's not that many patient numbers, so it really should not affect the ultimate comparison in a large study.
Where does intrahepatic chemotherapy fit into the algorithm, if at all?
Well, that could be a matter of opinion and, you know, institutional practice, but my personal feeling is that intrahepatic or intraarterial therapy has the purpose of delivering a higher dose of the fluoropyrimidine based on first-pass metabolism. As we're getting better and better chemotherapy, and especially targeted agents to add to the chemotherapy, you know, a little extra fluoropyrimidine-type drug is not going to have that big of a benefit. So I'm really not very convinced at this point that it has a major role, especially it hasn't been really compared adequately to peripheral infusion. I mean, one thing that's been done in the studies was infusion in the hepatic artery versus bolus. But a couple of European studies that looked at infusion in the hepatic artery versus infusion in your arm vein really did not show a benefit. So, you know, the infusion thing could confound it as well. So I think it's a relatively modest difference when you line up all the therapeutic tools we have now available to us.
In these various studies, looking at these two biologic strategies, to what extent have tissue correlation or translational studies been built in? And what are the kinds of things that people are trying to look at to predict responsiveness?
There's probably a lot more room for looking at those kind of questions, and I don't think we particularly know what the right questions to ask are. So whether, you know, there's some kind of thing you can measure for sensitivity to a particular targeted agent or not, we haven't done a good job of understanding those, so I think that that's an area that needs additional study.
It's pretty frustrating when you think about it. Anything promising coming along?
There are quite a few new targeted agents that are working on some of the same pathways and some of the other pathways that are more downstream, mTOR inhibitors, IGF inhibitors. I mean, I think that we're going to see a new round of targets beyond VEGF and EGF coming up shortly, and I think those will add additional therapeutic benefit.
The Think Tank group tackled this difficult issue, beginning with Dr. Haller, who responded to a chat room question from the audience as follows, quote, given recent data that a radiologic response to systemic therapy doesn't mean complete surgical path response, explain how a patient becomes resectable after being unresectable.
In most instances, it isn't because, as you allude to, the data show that pathologic complete responses of those lesions that were clinical complete responses, it's only about 5% of instances where there is not viable tumor or tumor does not grow where there was tumor before.
Could you talk about where that data came from?
It came from Renee Adams' group, I believe, did it not? Yes. And so what they did was resect the areas where there were complete responses. Very few actually didn't have tumor. And if they left them in place without doing RFA or another destructive procedure, they grew back. So I think it's optimistic to think that you can not operate on the area of the liver where tumor used to be and expect that even the biologics will convert macroscopic visible disease into pathologic CRs. And your question was?
Their question was, and how do you convert unresectable to resectable?
It primarily has to do with location and vascularity.
Yeah, it's a technical issue.
It's a technical issue. So if you have a lesion that is up near the vessels and you need to be away from it, that's the primary reason. One of the programs that uses this is the OncoSurge program. And in general, what I learned from that, this is a user-based program for looking at liver metastases, and it's on the web, and it's a very useful project. It's been presented, and it was published in JCO by Graham Poston. And what I learned from the surgeon sitting in the room with them and going through 100 cases of a learning set and a validation set, it's usually the geography that drives unresectability, not the number.
That's a fascinating project.
It was fascinating to participate in it. It was really run by UCLA RAND on a decision analysis model. And we had a fun time. I'll tell you, there was a lot of disagreement. And part of it was testiness after going through 100 cases and then coming back again and 6 months later doing the validation set and then sitting on planes and doing a third validation set. But it's very useful because it keeps people thinking. And the most important thing to think about is that the first thing to ask in a patient with metastatic disease is, are they curable? Not which chemo to use or which biologic to use. What is your end game? Because when you pick the therapy, especially if you're going to do liver resection, you do not want to refer that patient 24 months down the road when they're end stage. That has to be the surgeon who's going to do the surgery should be upfront with it and be involved upfront and have decision making. Because as we've seen, more chemotherapy is not always better in the neoadjuvant setting.
Axel, how do you approach these patients, and what do you think about this strategy in a non-protocol setting?
First of all, there was a question here online whether OncoSurge is available, and it is available. You can Google it. You can Google almost anything in the world. You'll find yourself in OncoSurge. And it's interactive. You can actually put in, it's actually really nice, and we've used it in our for demonstration part. But the problem is that it's a little bit outdated because it doesn't include the biologics, which of course now is the question, should we routinely include these biologics in our situation? And I think that what we need in the neoadjuvant setting is response rate, more than delaying of tumor progression, but only response rate to the extent, not until we don't see the metastasis anymore, because the timing of surgery is an issue. I heard the statement, the medical oncologist's dream is a surgeon's nightmare, complete response in a liver metastasis, which of course we know is not a complete response by PATH criteria. So I personally shoot for a response rate, and we have a lot of discussion here on FOLFOXIRI, which I think is intriguing because it did push response rates, and in the European setting where all these drugs are off patent and cheap, you know, this is actually a cheapest way to induce high response rate. In the United States, where the situation is a little bit different and reimbursement structures are partially based on drug costs, I think biologics can play a role and should play a role, and I can easily see that the rationale for using EGF receptor antibodies are higher based on Allen's and other data, that there is consistent response rate benefit when we add cetuximab. But we have limited data on that. We're still waiting on the phase 3 first-line trial results with cetuximab. And whether or not we should add bevacizumab then is a very different question. So I think for now, basic message would be, yes, response rate is our kind of surrogate marker for resectability if we use it first-line neoadjuvant therapy. However we get there might be an area of discussion.
Bottom line is, what would you be most likely to utilize right now?
Right now, we have an ongoing trial, FOLFOX cetuximab in the phase.
Okay, off study.
Off study. I've used FOLFOX bevacizumab. I've used FOLFOX cetuximab.
How about both, as per Howard?
Not yet.
Alan?
Not yet.
Well, so 80405, which thank you for the plug. One of the endpoints is to analyze the number of patients who go to surgery. Of course, it's very hard to legislate that and know if you're going to get the kind of data you'll get. Off study, I would not use double biologics, largely because I think we still need insurance authorization to use cetuximab up front, and I don't think we can get that. But I do agree the concept is you're looking for a response. I think the data that's very important to also dovetail with this is the observation from the ADOM group that if you don't respond, if you progress in the face of your frontline therapy, your likelihood of being cured by an operation is dramatically less. So I think it's a bioassay on the disease and the patient, and that to me serves a very important role so you don't subject patients unnecessarily to a big operation.
What about utilizing FOLFOXIRI or some combination that utilizes both?
Right, so FOLFOXIRI, there's some conflicting data in the literature. There's a paper from the Hellenic Oncology Society in Greece that actually was in British Journal of Cancer that showed no benefit whatsoever, more toxicity and no benefit to FOLFOXIRI compared to FOLFIRI. And so I think the jury's out. I mean, it would be interesting to see if there's an added benefit. I think the other point that we have to get at is not offering too much chemotherapy to these patients because of the risk of steatohepatitis or other hepatic damage. And so our approach is to treat for four doses, usually FOLFOX, Bev. In a patient who you deem resectable at that point, we stop the bevacizumab, give another dose of FOLFOX, and then take them to surgery 6 weeks after their last dose of bevacizumab. I think if you treat too much, you may eradicate the disease, then the surgeon doesn't know where to go, believe it or not. But you also may get a fatty liver, and the experienced hepatic surgeon can tell you that the liver is like mush in some of these patients if they've been too heavily pretreated.
Howard, what's your experience with isolated peritoneal metastatic disease?
Well, those patients we've tended to give chemotherapy first, and then we have gone back and operated on a few.
Peritonectomies?
I think they remove at least nomentectomy in all disease, similar to what a GYN oncologist would do in the case of ovarian cancer. So, you know, basic kind of peritoneal resection to the maximal amount. And then in my institution, we'd even consider giving intraperitoneal FUDR. So
Dan, there's actually a paper from Germany published in JCO, a randomized phase 2 trial of peritoneectomy. Now consider the rarity of the situation in the patient selection, but peritoneectomy versus peritoneectomy with intraoperative chemotherapy. And there seemed to be some benefit in disease-free survivorship. And again, this falls in the pattern of the Paul Sugarbaker malignancy mode. So in the patient who has, I would not eliminate that patient from the thought of doing such a thing. It's a rare patient. It may be 1 in 100 we'll have that situation.
Actually, the case Coward presented last summer was a patient with peritoneal disease and surgically resectable liver disease. What about patients like that, Dan?
Even Renee Adam would probably shy away from that one. But I think sometimes we say things don't work because we never try them, as if there were negative trials all over the place, or we go to the extent, I mean, we're talking about adjuvant chemotherapy when we have no idea that it works yet because the ERTC trial in resectable liver metastases won't even be mature for PFS until ASCO of this year and not for overall survival for long after that. I mean, we're making a lot of assumptions that adjuvant chemotherapy works per se because conversion from unresectability to resectability is not that common event. What we're really talking about are two different situations.
I find it remarkable that, you know, the discussion here is really targeted to being so operatively aggressive from a group of non-surgeons. I mean, you have a patient with peritoneal metastases and liver disease. I mean, that is not a candidate for operative resection with a hepatectomy that could lead to serious consequences. It is highly, highly experimental. I think that, yeah, you can do a prospective case series with 90-some-odd patients and then come back and say that, in fact, you can get 5-year survivors in this setting and I'll be chastened. But until such time, I think that discussing removing portal nodes and peritoneal seeding operatively or using a little FUDR and leaving bulk disease behind, I think should be relegated to the setting of non-standard of care.
Neil?
And that's being kind.
We all agree, Norm.
Totally agree.
I'd like to first say, you know, I'd be happy to have Norm as my medical oncologist should I need one, first of all, regardless of what he thinks about us. But besides that, I mean, I think what you're seeing here, Norm, is the point that Dan highlighted, which is we've finally come around to realize that the most important question when we're faced as medical oncologists with somebody with metastatic disease is the goal of therapy for this patient cure? And cure requires surgical resection as a component of their management. And I think that's what we're hearing. And there are a lot of unknowns about what are the situations where we should be going for the gusto and not. And are there situations on the border where you're more in the realm of debulking as opposed to complete resection? And are there certain circumstances when that would be appropriate? And this is a pushing of the envelope, and this is research that needs to be done. And we look to your guidance to help design those studies.
I'm all for pushing of the envelope, but encumbered by data rather than unencumbered.